Mrs. Pravda, reel 5. So how did you get to safety after Mrs. Milder?
Well, Mrs. Milder really was terrified of the other people in the village. And she said, I think the only opportunity to hide would be in the poor house. You know, every village had a house for poor old people, which is full of Russian workers. They were dragged from Ukraine to work like slave labor, and they made hide you because you speak the language. And we said, of course we shall leave. And I tell you, the crossing of the road gave me more horror, because suddenly I felt I'm saved and I'm free. So the cross this road in the village made me more frightened than all the march somehow. Because once you have hope again, you're more frightened. So when it was pitch dark, we crossed this snowy road and we knocked on the door of this poor house. It was opened by a very tall and bony woman with a number hanging round her neck. And I speak Russian. I learned it in the last 2 years in my high school, but I had to choose between English and Russian, and unfortunately for my future I chose Russian instead of English. It was so much nearer to Czech, so much easier to learn. So I tried to explain to her who we were. She didn't want any explanation at all. She locked the door, she put us to the table, she said in Russian, "Oh, you poor, poor girls." And she started to feed us immediately. And she fed us better than all the educated doctors later on. She knew that our stomachs wouldn't be able to take solid food or greasy food. And she gave us jelly, calf's jelly, and a bit of diluted milk and plain bread. And in spite of that, we had terrible diarrhea. Terrible, terrible, terrible. But we ignored it. We completely ignored it. We fed ourselves again and again and again. And in about 4 or 5 days, she was hiding us there. She didn't talk about it. She didn't ask us if we were Jewish, where we came from, what we are. Not a question. We were brothers against the Germans. And there were two other men there who went hunting during the night. That means a lot of the house, of the landlords left, and there were cows and calves and porks and everything. So they brought during the night some meat home. Nobody asked where they killed the goose. And we started slowly to eat more. And I wish to cut the long story short. I had to, there were still Germans in the village, and they came to control these poor Russians there. And they had to say, here we have two foreigners, but I was able to persuade the Germans that we are Czech people dragged to slave labor, as we didn't have any cross and any tattooed on our arms. You see, they couldn't decide who we were. And as I was fluent in German, I said, yes, we are both teachers from Czechoslovakia, and now the front is coming. Nobody cares what we are doing. So they said, you must come and milk the cows, because we haven't got enough people in the farm, on the farm. So the first time in my life I tried to milk a cow, which was not a success. But by that time the Germans were packing, they were running away. And in a few days the whole farm was just full of raging bulls and unmilked cows, and not a human being anywhere. So by that time it was clear that the front was coming. I and my friend harnessed a horse. First time in life, you can do anything. You can do anything. I'm terrified of animals, except dogs. To harness a horse, I didn't know how to, but eventually we managed. And we took one of those open wagons for grass, or whatever you call these wagons, and put some rice and whatever we found in that farm on it, and few blankets, and we rode with that horse.
What was your intention?
To go home. to find out where we are and what was going on. Again, there was no information, there was no radio, we didn't know. But we joined a group, an immensely large group of Polish people, Russian people, anybody who was moving away from this battlefield, because it was starting to be a battlefield. The Russians were pushing towards German borders. And I met a Russian officer, a girl, a Jewish girl, who sat on a horse, and she was in a most wonderful position because she was distributing vodka. So the soldiers were queuing like lamb to each of them get a cup of vodka from this lovely girl. And I asked her, I said, what shall we do? We don't know where we are. We didn't know where we were. We knew we were somewhere near Auschwitz, but God knows where. What shall we do? When do you think the end of the war will come? And that was the first 2 weeks in February when I asked her this question. And she said, in May. How did she know, Adam? And I said, should we go towards Czechoslovakia? She said, no! There'll be a lot of fighting. You must cross the front and you must aim to go into Poland. Go to Częstochowa. Follow.
She was an officer in the Russian army?
Yes. She was a captain because of the vodka. She was delightful. And she said, you must cross the... Walk in the night. Walk till you come. And it took us 2 weeks to walk to Częstochowa. When we reached Częstochowa, there were already groups of Czech prisoners there. There was a group of men who married Jewish women who were not Jewish themselves and who were in a sort of a milder concentration camp by the end of the war. And they occupied a school and they greeted us with open arms. They didn't have any beds. We slept on overturned wardrobes. But they were behaving beautifully. And they were again ignoring our shaved heads and our lice and everything. And then the Russians did a most sensible thing. They invited all prisoners to be deloused. And they did it by a stationary train. There was a train standing there. And you walk through the first wagon where they stripped you naked, put you under shower, and they took all these dirty clothes away. They put them in hot steam. We still didn't have a possibility to change our clothes. There was nothing anywhere unless you robbed somebody. So you got your stiff, clean rags back again. And you were clean. You were scrubbed and you were clean, which was the biggest bliss in the world to get to say goodbye to the Laos. And then we stayed in that school till one day a Russian officer came and said, if you want to return, it was Easter. It was Easter time. If you want to return back to your country, half the country is already liberated. Slovakia is free. And Carpato-Russia, which they robbed us of later. And they put us on a train, but this train was traveling only a few hours a day. Because it was a munition train, and we were sort of additionally burdened to the train. It was not our train. And it always stopped and then traveled and stopped and traveled. And the wagons were not for people. We had a little stove in the middle and sat on the planks of the wagons, covered wagons, thank God. And we crossed the Carpathian Mountains. And before we crossed them, I asked the permission to sit on the locomotive outside. And it's a most wonderful feeling to see the snowy mountains but chucked through, crossed them, and came into a place called Uzhhorod. And Then, from Uzhhorod, how I got there, I don't know. I think I heard that there are some Czech doctors, Red Cross doctors, who came from England through Persia, through Iran, you know, to look after the wounded and the prisoners. And they brought me to Košice. And when I was in Košice, I was hearing the bells ringing, peace. And I collapsed, completely and utterly collapsed. They were feeding me on hard-boiled eggs. This is why I have a mistrust towards doctors. All these lovely Czech doctors who studied many years knew much less about food and diet than the simple Russian peasant. They gave me eggs, they gave me meat, and the reaction was a terrific jaundice. My liver couldn't take it. I felt very, very ill. And then once I got, not yellow, but orange color, they said, oh dear, perhaps we shouldn't have given you that food. And that's how my war ended.
Was there beating at Auschwitz?
Yes. Yes, unfortunately. I have seen it, not only heard about it. It wasn't enough for the Germans to put people into gas chambers and apparently watch them through the glass, how they were choking slowly to death. I have seen a man, because there was a man. I mean, Auschwitz was immensely big. We never knew when we were marching through, you know, what you see. There were the children behind one fence and behind the other, the men who sometimes whistled melodies of Beethoven to let us know they are there. And I have seen a man being beaten by two SS men to death. He was kneeling between rails. God knows if he tried to escape or if he tried to take a piece of bread. I don't know what they were beating him for, perhaps for nothing, for the pleasure of it. And you feel desperate because you can't do anything about it. With screaming and beating a human being to death takes some time, and it's a ghastly thing. The other thing in Auschwitz was there was a woman in our tent who walked around in the barrack and said, I'm too delicate to take it. And we were rather rude to her. And we said, oh, goodness sake, you stupid girl. All of us are delicate. Nobody wants to go through this. But the next day, she jumped on the electrified wire, and she died. She really was too delicate to take it. Myself, I was beaten only once. Again, I don't know why. The SS man knocked me over the head with a stick, with a heavy stick. And he was, I don't know, they were distributing something, perhaps I pushed a head or some, I don't remember. He hit me, and by the end of the day I had a terrific headache, and it produced a fury. And I was walking around and saying, I'm going to kill him. Girls kept saying, don't be silly. I said, I'm going to kill him. If it cost me my life, I don't care. I'm going to kill him. Nobody's going to beat me. But of course, the fury abated, and next day I didn't kill him. That was my own experience of physical violence towards myself. But I have seen this man die.
Did you come across cases of experimentation on human beings?
No. No, because the people who were experimented on and the children who were experimented on were definitely isolated from the healthy young people in the part of the camp where we were. I only heard about it after the war. I met a strange thing. On the train from Uzhhorod to Košice, we came upon a 5-year-old child. His name was Pepiček. And he started to say that he was a twin and that he was in a barrack where there were only small children, and they took away his sister to do something with her. He didn't know what. There were the barracks where Mengele experimented on children. And he was, in his little brain, having the SS mixed with the Wolf and Red Riding Hood. He was mixing all these things together. And he was a frail little child, and he was saying, I said, how did you dress and what did you do? And he said, we helped each other. My sister and I, we dressed each other. And then they took her away, and I have never seen her. And they left me behind. And he was liberated by the Russians, so obviously he was put on a train. And I very nearly brought this child home, but I didn't have any experience with children. So we left him with a rabbi. With a rabbi who had children, and he said, I'm going to look after this boy. But his tales were so confused that you didn't know where the real horror started and where the fairy tale took off.
How old was he?
5. So that's my only personal evidence of these things. The rest I had after the war.
Did the experiences in the camps make people feel more religious or not?
Well, you can only ask individuals. Religious in the way that God would interfere with our lives? Certainly not. Because all the prayers sent to heaven for the sake of relatives were not heard. It gave me what later on I discover in book of Arthur Koestler, what he calls the oceanic feeling. With me it's nothing to do with water. A feeling that your spirit is completely independent of your body. If you would call it religion, you could call it a religion. I felt immortal. And not terribly worried. But I stopped believing that prayers help. Because these were completely innocent people dying in the most horrible circumstances. So if an interfering God, a God who will who will be on the phone, could hear them, he couldn't resist to answer, and he didn't.
So you had the feeling that what was happening to your body was happening to somebody else?
Not entirely schizophrenic. I knew this is a sort of a luggage you travel in, and if the luggage is very damaged, then of course you have to part with it. I wasn't detached from the body. I felt everything. But I wasn't worried. It was more like if you were wearing gloves, you know your hands are inside. The gloves are wearing thin. Your hands are getting very cold because of the bad gloves. But if you throw them away, well, so what? It wasn't resignation. Don't take it for resignation. It was a feeling, it's very strange to say about oneself, a feeling of immortality, that there is something they can't damage. I don't know if you would call it religion, would you?
Maybe. Did you feel that you might not survive, or did you feel that you would always survive?
Well, apart from the moment when he told me he's going to shoot me, where it was obvious I'm not going to survive in the next 10 minutes, I felt strong enough. I was at the top of my strength, I would say, as a woman, that I shall survive. Because I won't give them the pleasure to die, you see. But I didn't know. Of course I didn't know. But I wasn't in fear of death. No, not for one moment.
Did you ever come across any good guards?
Well, the one who saved my life.
Apart from him?
Apart from him, I would say that the commander of our camp, who was a completely idiotic, I would say Bavarian peasant, with about 3 teeth in his mouth, God knows how he became a commander of even a small unit camp, you know, because it was a great honor to be a SS with the black devilish uniforms and the crossbones, etc., etc. Now, that must have been a man who was certainly not a good man, but by not shooting the people who were left behind, he showed a certain humanity or common sense. Apart from the hanging of that one poor girl who tried to escape, they were not deliberate atrocities away from Auschwitz. That's what I can say. And this wonderful woman who hid us and saved our life, yes, there must be good Germans. I think the only difference between Germans and other nations is, in my opinion, that the percentage of cruel, sadist, and pagan people is much higher than in any other nation I have met. They have their superstition and Valhalla and their Germanic gods very, very deep, and they completely despise the Bible and Ten Commandments, you see. They don't believe in it.
Do you think that your experience has left any long-term effects with you?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I was a culture snob to start with. I disdained people who didn't read the right books. I was snooty as a girl. Now I know it's not important. It's nice, but it's not important. The only important thing is the character, the goodness, unselfishness. And the other thing, which is a bad thing, it left me, first of all, without believing into any prayer. Secondly, it left me unnecessarily worried about every disease of people I loved. And I lost my husband recently, and I worried all these years about him. And it left me over-anxious about my only son. And it crippled my memory. I used to have a brilliant memory. And now I have a memory which has black spots. Almost a damaged memory. And after the war, for many years, I suffered through a fear of hunger, which demonstrated itself that I couldn't sleep until my stomach was completely full. So I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning and had to have a huge piece of bread. And when I spoke to other former prisoners, they have the same. You know, the feeling that you are hungry is a sort of a threat to your life. So during the day, you don't eat too much. But in the evening, you can't go to bed without having a piece of bread or something next to you. It's ridiculous. It's funny. But it persists. And you don't sleep. You don't sleep unless you have this piece. Very funny. Apart from it, I hope not. The only thing one asks oneself after surviving, because only 2% of Czech Jews survived the war. So if you imagine a row of 100 girls and 2 haphazard are picked out and say, you will live and the other will die, you're bound to ask yourself, why me? I haven't been more clever. I certainly wasn't stronger. I was always a very small and very unhandy person. I wasn't particularly talented. Why me? It's a great mystery, but I think one of the duties we have is to be witness, to tell the truth, to prevent people saying it never happened, or it happened like it is, like it was overdone, it was propaganda, it was, of course, war, and in war you can expect atrocities. It's absolute nonsense. They organized the murder on such an industrial scale that you can't compare it to a terrorist act or a bomb attack or something like this at all. because it was meant to go on. It was meant to eliminate all the Slav people, all the gypsies who are nowadays forgotten, all the religious people who were against it. There were not only the Jews. There were millions of best people in Europe who were planned to be killed. They had it all on paper. They planned it. And that it could be today, after 40 years, that there are people who are getting up in America and Germany and everywhere to say it never happened or it didn't happen. I think we are the witnesses, and perhaps we were picked up for that.